And now here's Dr. Allison McGeer.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. What I'm going to do in the next 40 minutes or so is in the overview, which is on the second slide of your presentation. If you're looking at the first slide, however, let me tell you first of all that my email is there so that you can find me, and underneath that is our website, which we try to keep updated with slides and other pieces of information, and people are welcome to use it. What I'm specifically going to talk about this afternoon on slide two is, first of all, an overview of influenza in general. We will whip through the slides, which you are welcome to use at any time for in-services or other presentations. What I'm going to do now is just highlight the issues that are relevant to hospital-acquired influenza, talk about preparing for influenza season ahead of time, what we should be thinking about doing in the way of surveillance for influenza during the season, and then finally spend some time talking about the response to outbreaks. And as we, influenza is one of those things that as we start looking for it in acute care hospitals, we will almost certainly find more of it, and there are a number of challenging questions about what we're supposed to do. So the next slide shows you a schematic of the influenza virus. A small RNA virus only makes 10 proteins, and on the surface of that virus are hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, which are the two antigens on which our immunity is based. Just skip over the next few slides, which one of which is an electron micrograph of influenza, and the second of which is a schematic of how influenza infection works. Just a reminder here that influenza virus only infects the cells of the respiratory tract. In humans, it is very difficult to find influenza elsewhere in the body, and in fact, the symptoms from influenza come the systemic effects of local cytokine release, not because it's a systemic infection, even though it feels like a systemic infection. The next slide, labeled clinical characteristics of infection, is just an overview of the relevant clinical features of influenza. And there are two that are particularly relevant to dealing with influenza in healthcare institutions. The very bottom line of the table is labeled infectivity virus isolation. And it's important to point out to people that people start shedding influenza virus sometime between 6 and 24 hours before the onset of illness. So that no matter how good you are about restricting yourself when ill, as with many other infectious diseases, you will expose people prior to illness. The second relevant piece of information is the line graph on top is a temperature measurement, but after day one, in fact, is a pretty good reflection of what the pattern of viral isolation looks like. So viral isolation from influenza peaks on the first or second day of infection and then tails off fairly steadily. And as far as one can tell, under normal circumstances, people are not infectious more than 4 days after the onset of illness. The caveat, one of the things that we've all been struggling with in acute care facilities that I don't have a response to you for, is that often when residents from nursing homes come to us, they will come to us on day 4 or 5 of illness, and you do an NP swab, and their NP swab is still positive. You're then stuck in the situation where the guidelines say that those people should not be infectious because they're not infectious for more than 4 days, but the guidelines are written for the general population in the usual circumstances, and we know that the older and sicker you are, the lower your control over influenza virus replication is and the longer you're likely to be infectious. And so at least at the moment at Sinai, we treat those people as infectious for an additional, usually 3 or 4 days if they have a positive NP swab, because we know that having a positive NP swab is quantitatively with relatively heavy viral load. It is also true that for your most compromised patients, infants in neonatal intensive care units, patients on bone marrow transplant wards, that those patients can have a lot of difficulty controlling viral replication and can be infectious for long periods of time. And so our approach to our bone marrow transplant patients has been to repeatedly do NP swabs and to continue to keep them, treat them as infectious until their NP swab becomes negative, and that in a couple of circumstances has been more than 2 weeks. Okay. The next slide shows you the complications of influenza, and is only, all of you know this, and it's really only a reminder that one of the important messages that we need to get to staff who work in facilities is that when people come in during influenza season with pneumonia, it is frequently due to influenza. And one of the key things that I think we need to start doing in order to get our hospital staff to pay attention is incorporating a diagnosis of influenza into those patients. Not going to make a difference to how they're managed from a clinical perspective, but our hospital staff are not going to believe in influenza as a serious cause of illness until we can start to demonstrate to them that people who come to us severely ill are in fact severely ill from their influenza. And so I think part and parcel of getting people to pay attention to influenza in our acute care facilities is increasing our diagnostic tests for people who have complications so that we can understand, so that our staff can understand what influenza really does to people. Now, the picture here of the lady sneezing is a slide without data, and it's a slide without data specifically because we know less about the important aspects of transmission of influenza than any of us would like. The fundamental problem with transmission of influenza is twofold. The first is that we know that it can be transmitted both by direct contact and by droplet spread. There are two big research groups looking into the transmission of respiratory viruses, one in the UK and one in the US, and they have over time arrived at diametrically opposed views as to whether contact is more important than droplet. And nobody has so far found an explanation for why those different conclusions have occurred. And the take-home is that there is no way of knowing which is more important, and we need to be, when people are infectious with influenza, they need to be in both contact and droplet isolation. Now, the big-ticket question, of course, for those of us in infection control is whether we have to worry about airborne spread for influenza. And that, again, is a wide-open question. About 3 years ago at the Shea decennial meetings, somebody from the CDC got up and gave the first talk about influenza and definitively said that influenza was not transmitted by the airborne route. And then Fred Hayden, who's one of the academics in the United States who's done the most work on influenza, got up and said definitively it was transmitted by the airborne route. And that summarizes what we know about influenza. My reading of the literature is that influenza can sometimes be transmitted by the airborne route. There are a number of outbreaks, including one famous one on an aircraft, where the inevitable conclusion is that there was airborne transmission. However, it's equally clear that in the vast majority of circumstances in acute care hospitals, influenza is not transmitted by the airborne route. In fact, it tends not to be transmitted very readily. We all know that we admit substantial number of patients every winter with influenza, and we don't have influenza outbreaks all that commonly. So I'm quite happy with the circumstance that says that in most circumstances we treat influenza in acute care hospitals as if it's not spread by the airborne route. And the only time you really need to think about airborne spread is in the setting of outbreaks, because in that setting we need to be at least cognizant of the possibility and try to cover off that issue. Okay. The next slide is, again, just a reminder of the overall impact of influenza, and the third line in particular. This winter in Canada, something like 50,000 people will be hospitalized due to influenza, about 1% of the population over the age of 65. So there's a certain sense that says if we're going to take our heads out of the sand and pay attention to influenza, we're taking on a sizable chunk. So when you think about what your approach to influenza is going to be in an acute care hospital, you need to recognize that as you start looking, you're going to find it increasingly, and it's not going to be a really small item. Okay. Now, on the next set of slides, and if you have slides, you'll be able to follow this evolution. If you're looking at handouts, you'll see them in different colored gray bars. one of the critically important things in dealing with influenza in institutions is that influenza has separate and distinct seasons from other viruses. So that if you look at this first slide here, there's a bunch of darker gray bars on the bottom that represents kind of baseline viral respiratory tract activity. Okay, there's always some degree of viral respiratory tract infections. And then the lighter bars, which are yellow on the color, on top of them you'll see the average winter distribution, so that RSV and paraflu and adenoviruses and rhinoviruses tend to be distributed over the complete winter season. They start sometime at the end of September or October, and they last into April and May. Influenza, in contrast, and the red bars are the darkest bars on top, comes in a relatively contained season, okay? It's usually 6 to 8 weeks, sometimes a little bit longer. And that can occur any time from the end of November until into February. So the first slide here shows you an influenza season that occurred at the end of January, the beginning of February, more or less what happened last year in Ontario. And there you see that through November, December, and even in the first 2 weeks of January, there was viral activity, but there wasn't very much influenza. You really didn't need to be worried about the number of people with influenza. And then the end of January and February was when there was going to be influenza activity. You needed to worry about that. And by the middle of March, there really wasn't very much anymore. And if you look at the next slide is the representation of the 99-2000 season, where the season started in about the second week of December. And it was mostly packed into the last 3 weeks of December and January, and then mostly gone by February. And the slide after that shows you what happened in the first season of ACE Sydney, the 97-98 season. What you actually see is that influenza kind of took over. There was very little other viral activity and a huge amount of influenza activity in the end of December and January and into February. And the reason that's important, because if you're worried about influenza outbreaks, or if you're going to be focusing on doing surveillance for influenza, you don't want to be wasting your time doing it out of season, okay? It's not a very useful investment of effort to be doing influenza surveillance until you start to see it appearing in the community, until you know that you're at significant risk of influenza outbreaks. Okay. And the last slide in the series is just a winter without influenza, which is what in Ontario our 2000-2001 season was like, and what we will ultimately be able to achieve if we can just persuade enough people to get vaccinated. So this is the kind of holdout hope of where we're going with influenza. Slide after this is again a reminder about the impact of influenza and why it is that we care about influenza in acute care facilities. Influenza is the only infectious disease whose occurrence is best measured by death. And this is the U.S. surveillance system, because we don't have an equivalent system in Canada, looking at the spiky line is actual, the distribution of the percentage of deaths that are due to pneumonia and influenza in 122 sentinel U.S. cities. The double line that looks like a sine wave is the best regression model of what that variability is from season to season, always more pneumonia and influenza in the winter season than in the summer. And the places where the line spikes above, where the rough line spikes above the sine wave, is where you have influenza activity, okay? And so if you live in the United States and you follow these graphs as they evolve, when you start to see, the easiest way to know when the season is coming is when you start to see that line go above the sine wave pattern, then you know that you're looking at the next 6 weeks of influenza. In Canada, what you're dependent on is the flu watch system and local surveillance systems for influenza. In Ontario now, through the season, there's a weekly bulletin that comes from the Ministry of Health that you can get an email subscription to or that you can look up on the web. And over the last 3 years, they've gotten really good at posting things promptly so that you can tell what's coming. Now, in looking at how influenza occurs in hospitals and who gets sick, the next graph shows you a quick examination by the Institute for Clinical and Evaluative Sciences in Ontario of what we expect the load to be in illness due to influenza in acute care hospitals. So they looked at patients who had a physician diagnosis of nosocomial pneumonia. So probably reasonably specific, but not very sensitive, and people who had gone home and were readmitted with pneumonia within the 4 days immediately post-discharge, and counted those as nosocomial pneumonias. And what you see is that there's really no difference in nosocomial pneumonias between July and August and November and December. That's because most other respiratory viruses aren't associated with significant excess rates of pneumonia. But in particularly in the over 65-year age group, in January to March, which was the influenza season in 97-98, you see this 30% excess of nosocomial pneumonia. There is no other explanation for that except the occurrence of an excess of influenza in that year. And if you look at the table on the next slide labeled influenza in hospitals, you see that what that translates to is about 300 to 350 cases of nosocomial pneumonia across Ontario every year that are straight up due to influenza. Now, there's not a lot of more detailed data on rates of nosocomial influenza, but if you look on the next slide, there are three papers that have been published looking at the incidence of nosocomial influenza, and it's reasonably similar in those three studies, between 3 and 8 per 1,000 admissions during the season. And the case fatality rate is, in general, about 7%. So these are, remember, in vaccinated populations. You have an outbreak in at-risk unvaccinated people, the mortality is going to be higher. But influenza generally carries about a 7% mortality rate in vaccinated at-risk people. And the costs are substantial. And what that translates to in a 400 or 500-bed hospital is it costs somewhere between $20,000 and $25,000 a year in nosocomial influenza, which I think gives us a reasonably good target to shoot for. It tells us that both in the prevention of morbidity and mortality, but also in savings to hospitals, that influenza is something that we ought to be worried about. Now, the next slide is just to remind you that influenza outbreaks are common, and in fact, the number of published reports of influenza outbreaks in hospitals has increased dramatically in the last few years, really a function of paying attention to it. I couldn't fit them all on one slide, so I've just given you a range of selection. You can see that people have tended to pay more attention, as you might expect, to influenza outbreaks in neonatal intensive care units and transplant wards where the morbidity and mortality is higher. The duration of those outbreaks has been really variable depending on what control measures have been taken. And if you look at in the column labeled number of patient cases are the number of cases and then in brackets the number of patients who died, which tells you that there are certain circumstances, particularly the neonatal intensive care unit, but also in Kapila's study and in unvaccinated people, circumstances where the case fatality rate can be much higher than 7 to 10%. The last column is the rate of staph illness in these outbreaks, and you will see that it tends to be very difficult in outbreak investigations to get good numbers on staph illness, and we fundamentally don't have any. But it is also striking when you read these outbreaks that the majority of these outbreaks are associated with a cluster of ill staph early on. And that, in fact, is what you would expect, that staph are essential to an amplification effect that ends you up having an outbreak, that a single person coming into the hospital with influenza probably doesn't have the ability to transmit to enough other patients to cause a problem. But a single patient to a staff member, to three other staff members, to six other patients is what gets you into trouble. So let's talk about protecting acute care hospitals from the risks of influenza. And there are a number of ways that we can minimize risk, okay? The first thing we want to do is minimize the risk that people who are either infected with or incubating influenza get into the hospital. Anybody walking through the doors of the hospital is a potential risk, and the more time you spend close to patients and the longer you spend in the facility, the greater the risk is. The second thing you want to do is to try to reduce the risk of transmission from the people who are ill with influenza, who you know are going to come into your facility and have to be cared for. Recognizing and managing individual cases so that they are not infectious if possible or infectious for a minimal amount of time will obviously help. And finally, detecting outbreaks at the stage where you have 3 or 4 people as opposed to 20 people will clearly make a difference. So how do you minimize the risk of introductions? And the fundamental, obviously, of minimizing the risk of introductions is vaccination. And that vaccination is, the gain you get is not only from vaccinating patients and staff, but from vaccinating anybody who comes through the door of your facility. So the first is patients. Most of us are getting reasonably good at vaccinating our long-stay patients, but it's still something that we have to check every year, that you know, somebody on our service is cognizant of people waiting for nursing home placement and getting them vaccinated. The second thing that you want to think about is whether you have patients who are likely to go home and return during influenza season and whether they're going to be vaccinated. On our medical unit, 70% of the patients on our floor at any given time will be back in the hospital within 6 months, most of them within 3 months. So it's a safe bet that when we have any patients on that floor during October and November, that they're going to be back with us at some time during influenza season. And it is probably worthwhile investing some effort in trying to make sure that those patients get vaccinated. Now, many of them will get vaccinated at their family physicians, but where we've identified the issue is at Sinai is the elderly medical patients in nursing homes, not a problem. The slightly younger surgical patients and medical patients who are under subspecialty cares, family physicians sometimes tend to be a little nervous about doing anything that interferes with their care. And our subspecialists tend to be completely focused on their area of interest and don't know a lot and often don't actively recommend influenza vaccine to patients under their care. So I think it's worth thinking about whether you have a hole in those patients that you can do something about. Obviously, vaccinating staff, volunteers, and physicians makes a difference. Anybody who crosses the doors, and in particular, anybody who has patient contact is a potential risk, and anything that you can do for minimal cost will help. At Sinai, in our staff vaccination campaign, although it's directed at staff, we offer vaccine to anybody who is in the facility at the time, to the parents of our infants in neonatal intensive care units in particular, to visitors of our long-stay patients. And that is completely out of self-interest, okay? That's building a wall of protection around the hospital. There is a lot of concern always from occupational health departments and administration about the liabilities associated with that. The OHA did put out a document last year looking at the liabilities associated with vaccinating people who are not your staff, and in 8.5 pages of dense, singly spaced text, they told you that you could be in trouble if you vaccinated them, and you could equally be in trouble if you didn't vaccinate them. And so I think that using that provides a lot of support for having available vaccine to other people in your facility. A reminder always, and I know this is preaching to the converted, that we now have two large randomized control trials demonstrating that vaccinating staff reduces mortality, not just illness, but actual death in residents. And the next slide, labeled Effective Influenza Vaccine, is the first of those trials published by Potter in the Journal of Infectious Diseases in 97. And just look at that, the top left box on the table. Homes that offered vaccine to their healthcare workers, or chronic care hospitals who offered vaccine to their healthcare workers, had a 44% reduction in all-cause mortality in their patients during the influenza season. And in response to the fact that most of us looked at that and said, that's too big, that can't be true, the group repeated the staff vaccination segment in a second randomized controlled trial, and that's shown in the graph on the next slide, published by Carnon et al. In The Lancet in 2000. And you can see the cluster of red dots at the 0 to 10% is those facilities that were randomized to not offering vaccine. And then in facilities where staff were offered vaccine, the vaccination rate ranged from just under 30% to about 70%. And you can see, again, a very striking reduction in mortality associated with staff vaccination. So that anything that we can do to increase vaccination rates in the people who might introduce influenza will make a difference. The second means of minimizing the risk of introduction is focusing on not having ill people in the facility. And there are two potential ways that you can do this. One is active attempts to restrict visitors during influenza season. You obviously don't want to do this during the entire winter season, but it may not be an unreasonable thing to do during the peak of influenza season For those of us in larger hospitals and centers, having a information given to patients when they come, because people often call ahead of time before they come to visit, and having signs up requesting that people with upper respiratory tract infections do not come in to visit might have an impact, or at least a easy thing to do. For people who live in smaller communities may have things like local papers and other mechanisms of getting the message out to people in winter season. One of the good things about Ontario's Universal Flu Program and the attention we're paying to influenza is it's easier to get the general public now to pay attention to influenza and the potential risks. Now, your second approach that you have to think about is what you can do about restricting ill healthcare workers during influenza season. Most of us, I think, have regarded that as not a viable thing to do, but there are, in fact, a number of hospitals that have chosen to do this and where it works. And fundamentally, what the guideline would be in this circumstance is that healthcare workers need to report respiratory illness. When they report respiratory illness, you do a rapid test for influenza, and if it's influenza, then you restrict them until 3 days after the onset. There is no published evidence that this is of what benefit you get from this, and I think most people look at this as being a very difficult thing to do and one that is likely in situations where we're already short of staff to make us even shorter of staff. But then when I think of that, I remember that when we talked about restricting in Ontario, when we introduced the new guideline that said that in long-term care facilities, if you weren't vaccinated and didn't take amantadine prophylaxis, that you had to be restricted for the duration of the outbreak. And most people's response to that is we're going to be in big trouble, okay? We will not have staffing to deal with outbreaks. And what they forgot, which is what we all tend to forget, is that when you have outbreaks, if you have unvaccinated staff who aren't on prophylaxis, they all get sick anyway. So they're going to be off, okay? And you're not actually going to make things worse by sending them off a little bit earlier. They're still going to be off for a good long period of time because their chances of being ill are so high. So that those of us in infection control need to think very carefully about how to start introducing policies that attempt to identify staff with influenza and reduce their risk of transmission over the period of time they're infectious. The next big ticket item is trying to reduce the risk of transmission from sporadic cases. And we know now, if you flip to the next slide after hand washing and just look at the slide that says impact of hand hygiene on infections, this is an overall summary slide of studies looking at the reduction in infections, and I just want you to look at the three studies on the bottom. These are studies of 2001 study. Ryan is hand washing on an army base. The two 2000 studies are alcohol-based hand disinfection in schools. And in all three of those circumstances, washing your or disinfecting your hands about 5 times a day resulted in a 25 to 40% reduction in all viral respiratory illness. Okay, so very clearly, there's no reason to believe that transmission in hospitals is going to be any different than transmission in the community for these viruses. And anything that we can do to improve hand washing compliance will reduce transmission during influenza season. And I'm wondering, I don't think people have tried to do this, but it did occur to me to wonder as I was thinking about what we were doing with influenza this year, whether a reminder to staff about hand wash protecting them from getting influenza and other infections from their patients and taking it home might be a way of getting a bit of a jump on both hand washing and reduction in transmission of influenza viruses. Okay, skip over now to reducing transmission 2, and this is something that we can all deal with. During influenza season, we want to identify patients who come to us who are still shedding significant quantities of influenza and making sure that they don't transmit. And there are two parts to identifying those infected patients. One is the introduction of rapid influenza testing in the emergency departments for people being admitted to the hospital with acute respiratory tract infections. And 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said that getting our eMERGE staff to do nasopharyngeal swabs for this was close to impossible, but it has been a little bit slow but surprisingly easy and does get these patients identified and into droplet and contact precautions as necessary. The second system that works when you have it organized is rapid between-facility notification of influenza outbreaks, something we don't have working very well in the Toronto area at the moment, but obviously knowing which facilities have outbreaks that patients or residents are being transferred from really helps in the process of identifying and isolating patients. Patients who are still infectious should be in a private room if possible, and if not, at least in droplet and contact precautions. And the duration of precautions in general is either 3 to 4 days or until their nasopharyngeal swab is negative. Rapid tests for influenza on nasopharyngeal swabs cost about $17 a test, so they're not something you want to use in vast quantities, but in circumstances where you're really worried about somebody with severe immunocompromise who may still be infectious, it's not generally a major issue doing a second nasopharyngeal swab to make sure that they're negative and that their reduction in infectivity is there. And the next slide is just a look at what we know about duration of shedding. As I've said before, in healthy and hospitalized immunocompetent adults, you generally shed for 3 or 4 days. And so 4 days after the onset of illness, people can come out of isolation. Elderly adults and children shed for longer, and so they will often present on day 2 or 3 of illness and then may need to be in isolation for an additional 4 days. Infants and severely immunocompromised patients may shed for much longer periods of time, and those are the people where you probably want to follow with NP swabs what their infectivity is. Okay, so now let's spend the last 10 minutes or so going through these slides on what to do about outbreaks. The first thing about outbreaks is that, as always with outbreaks, preparation is everything. And the more you do ahead of time to know exactly, outbreaks always happen on Friday, usually the Friday before a long weekend, right? And the more you have in place about what you're going to do, the less discussion you need, the easier it is to get through it. And what you need in the way of policies is a written policy that says that you will routinely reoffer staff vaccine, a decision about what antiviral you're going to give to patients, and a medical directive for antiviral orders. Commonest problem that hospitals and until recently long-term care facilities get into is they depend on multiple physicians to write antiviral orders. This tends to get you misdosing of amantadine, and it makes it a long, slow process. You need to have this. You need to decide ahead of time which antiviral you're going to choose. You need to have the medical directive written so that you can walk up and get patients on drug now and not 6 or 8 or 12 or 24 hours from now if you can't find the physician responsible. You need to decide what antivirals you're going to offer for staff, and that includes both a choice of which antivirals you're going to offer and how much choice you're going to give them, a decision about who's going to pay for it for people who are covered and aren't covered by insurance, and how you're going to get it to the staff once you've decided to give it to them, and a clear decision about what your work restriction policies are going to be for staff so that everybody knows ahead of time what those rules are going to be. In terms of communications for preparation, all of your staff and your public health need to be clear about what the policies are, and these discussions need to now be incorporated into discussions with unions. The decision that went against St. Peter's last year about restriction during their outbreak was not a decision that you couldn't restrict people during an outbreak. It was a decision that said that it hadn't been brought up in union negotiations, it hadn't been fully discussed with staff, and you couldn't do it unless you had worked through the process or public health had written a medical directive saying you had to do it. Okay, so having worked through the process ahead of time is important to the success of what you're doing. Ideally, you'd like to have pamphlets prepared so that you can give information to patients and visitors. It's just a question of printing things off so people know about influenza and what the rules are going to be. On Friday night at 7 o'clock, you're going to need to be able to identify which staff are vaccinated and which staff are not vaccinated when you're doing staffing for the weekend. And most of the time, occupational health departments are closed at that time, so there needs to be a way of being able to do that. And the last thing is always with outbreaks is you need to be sure that you're going to know where your patients have gone, and that's particularly important with influenza outbreaks because the timelines for identifying people are short. You don't want people setting off outbreaks in other facilities. Now, if you're going to detect outbreaks, then you're going to need to have a surveillance system. And I think that the principles of setting up surveillance systems is, first of all, having reminders when the influenza season starts. So you're not expecting that people are going to be watching for respiratory outbreaks necessarily for the whole year, but that they are paying attention during the two-month period of relevance. And what you're looking for is, first of all, acute respiratory illness in patients and clusters of acute respiratory illness in staff. The surveillance for staff is very difficult to do in an organized fashion, but I think if we can convince the nursing staff and the people, and it's a little different in every facility, who are in charge of staffing responsibilities to keep their eyes open for when they get an excess of people calling in sick, that has worked well for us in the detection of Norwalk-like outbreaks, and I think can, as long as they know it's an issue and who to talk to about it, is actually a system that works, even though it's not one that comes with numbers. I think ultimately in acute care facilities we will move to a setting whereby when people get an acute respiratory illness during the influenza season that we would do NP swabs to detect the first illness. We're clearly moving there with long-term care facilities so that you detect any nosocomial transmission and outbreaks very early on. And those swabs are cheap enough and easy enough to do that we probably should be doing it routinely. Now, once you start looking, obviously you will find an occasional patient who has nosocomial influenza, and that patient could have had influenza from a visitor or another patient or some staff member who's gone home, and it's not necessarily that there's going to be an outbreak, but it should be a circumstance that you pay attention and make sure that you are going to detect any other cases of disease that occur in patients or staff. And similarly, it seems likely the most appropriate other triggers for enhanced surveillance is to patients with the acute onset of respiratory illness on one ward within 72 hours. That's a standard long-term care trigger now. And two or three staff who work together who develop acute respiratory tract infection within 24, 48 hours is another indicator that they may have acquired the infection on the floor. Once you know about this, then the question is an outbreak starting, or is this just going to be some small cluster that goes away? And what you need to be able to do is activate NP swabs for staff if possible. It's obviously much more difficult, and patients certainly who develop any acute respiratory illness. It's also important here to go back and look for missed cases. The experience in long-term care is that missed cases occur frequently, and until you've got really good surveillance systems in general, when you identify the first three cases, there's usually six or seven cases have already happened that you've missed. And so going back and looking for older missed cases is important. And finally, at this stage, you need to be able to notify administrative medical and nursing staff, because if something does go wrong, you want them to have a little bit of breathing space before the outbreak descends to think about what the implications are. Now, the next slide is labeled outbreaks confirmation and has a suggested definition for what an outbreak is in acute care facility based on what we know in long-term care facilities. And what you need to define an outbreak is at least three episodes of acute respiratory illness. Remember that a lot of your patients are compromised. Many of them are demented. A lot of them are previously vaccinated, so they're not going to have typical influenza-like illness. So any acute respiratory illness counts. At least two of those have to be positive for influenza. And the reason you want two is because you want to demonstrate that there has been transmission. Two positive for influenza will almost always say that one of them acquired it on the floor, so that you know that on that unit you've had transmission of influenza. And you also want that if you've done some testing that you haven't got other respiratory viruses circulating. When you have that, then you know you have an outbreak. And the case definition is the case definition that is usually used in long-term care outbreaks now. Obviously, it'll always vary a little bit, and I think there's an open question that says that on floors with younger and competent patients, particularly ones who are unvaccinated, that a stricter definition of influenza-like illness may well work fine. But very clearly in long-term care facilities, it doesn't work, and in most settings in acute care, it's not going to work either. So now let's talk about management in the setting of you have an outbreak. And the first thing you need to do with management is figure out what areas of the hospital and the time period are involved, think about whether you're going to close the unit or not. Identify people who might take influenza at other hospitals, okay, because the fact that you have an outbreak means that other people are at risk, and you'd really like to be able to preserve them. Stop the transmission on the unit and set up a system that's going to be able to tell you whether what you've done fixes the outbreaks, okay? So those are your top five things that you're going to do. And defining the areas of the hospital involved, again, is something that we don't have a lot of experience with in acute care. We know in long-term care that containment to one unit is almost always impossible. Okay? In general, if you've got a long-term care facility and starts on one unit, it will have spread by the time you detect it. This should not occur in acute care. We don't transfer staff back and forth between acute care. We tend not to have activities that involve residents on different units in acute care. And so, in general, it should be okay to define it to the unit. But there are also acute care hospital outbreaks that move to other units. So when you decide on the area of the hospital, you need to be clear that you're watching other areas of the hospital. And you also, at the same time, you want to go back and figure out what you think was the first exposure time and where the outbreak started. The next thing you're going to do is consider closing the unit. And considering that closing the unit, there are two questions involved. The first is that we are all stretched for beds, and what you're doing in this setting is trying to decide what the safest management is for the largest number of patients. Taking care of patients in the hallways of the emergency department is not ideal patient care, nor is moving patients up to a unit where you have transmission of influenza and they might get infected with influenza. And so there's never a clean answer to what the safest thing is for the most patients. You need to make an immediate decision at the time. And what you really don't want to do is close the unit and redeploy staff to other places, because if you do have an outbreak, you will have exposed a whole group of staff, and if you redeploy those staff to other places in the hospital, you may end up making things much worse. And on the bottom of that slide are a number of alternatives to what you may be able to do to avoid closing units when you simply can't close the unit in response to it. Okay. Next, you're going to think about who might have carried influenza to other hospitals, and you really want to let other hospitals know about recently transferred patients, and you want to communicate with unvaccinated staff who have worked in your hospital to make sure that the institutions and staff know they're at risk and can do something about instituting precautions, taking prophylaxis that will stop this outbreak from being transferred to other places. Outbreak management 4 then looks at stopping transmission from patients, and here you're going to do droplet and contact precautions for symptomatic patients, which means if you can, a private room or cohorting. You want to make sure, for instance, on our longer stay medical ward that activities are going to be canceled, that we do not transfer patients from the outbreak floor to other floors unless they're going in isolation on prophylaxis. And you need to think carefully about whether you want to restrict patients going to other facilities or other areas for tests. And most of the time you don't have to do that, but you just need to think about what the risks and benefits are to people leaving that floor. The next thing you're going to do about stopping transmission is think about antiviral prophylaxis. And when you're dealing with patients in antiviral prophylaxis, on the next slide, the most important thing you need to do is to classify patients into those who've been ill for more than 48 hours, where because influenza is a self-limited illness, prophylaxis isn't going to do any good, and if you're using amantadine, may select for resistance. Okay, so people who are ill for more than 48 hours, you don't want to give anything to. People who are acutely ill, you need to put in precautions, and you want to start them on treatment, because if they've been ill for less than 48 hours, treatment will reduce the duration of shedding and the likelihood of infectivity, in addition to making them a little better. And when you're giving treatment, you're only going to use neuraminidase inhibitors, either oseltamivir or zanamivir, because treatment with amantadine may select for resistance. And then you're going to classify people who are not ill yet and put them in prophylaxis. The next slide is a slide that I put up reluctantly because I dislike recommending drugs, especially new expensive drugs. But the truth of the matter, I think, is that for acute care hospitals, that for patient management, it is better to take the hit on a more expensive drug than to use amantadine. Why is that? Well, if you use oseltamivir, you deal with both influenza A and B outbreaks, and you don't have to have separate sets of policies for them, which makes it a bit easier. You also, with oseltamivir, have a single dosage regimen and no interactions. Okay, so the only thing you have to worry about in giving people oseltamivir is whether they have substantial degrees of renal failure, which in general is easy to detect in hospitals. If you use amantadine, you've got to assess every individual patient. You can do that in long-term care because your patient population is stable. But in acute care, you don't know who you're going to get. And I can tell you, I've sat and done it for 45 patients, and it took me 6 hours. And so the longer you have to spend assessing patients and knowing, thinking about drug interactions and dealing with what the dosing regimen is going to be, the longer you delay implementation. And you also spend a lot of money doing it, okay? You don't have to do that. The third thing is that oseltamivir has a very high toxic therapeutic ratio. It can't do people any harm with oseltamivir, but amantadine errors can be serious. And in the setting of ill staff and residents and stress is when you make medication errors, and there is, in fact, a resident of a long-term care facility who died in Toronto because of an amantadine error. You avoid that. Finally, amantadine is associated with fewer side effects in both patient and staff populations than amantadine is. And lastly, you don't have to worry about resistance. You always have to worry about exactly how you're handling amantadine and what the risk is, and that doesn't happen in acute outbreaks with oseltamivir. If you're going to use amantadine, the rules for amantadine are very clear. The first is that you must calculate a creatinine clearance for every patient based on their gender, their weight, and their serum creatinine. Just because they're under 65 does not mean that their creatinine clearance is normal, and you can't use standard doses for healthy adults in the acute care setting. You've got to go through their chronic illnesses and their medications for interactions and the risk of adverse events. Giving amantadine to people with seizure disorders or those people who are on drugs with anticholinergic side effects can cause serious reactions, and you don't want to do that. You must not treat symptomatic patients. You've got to be sure about who's symptomatic, who has influenza and who doesn't, because treating symptomatic patients is how you select for resistance and get second waves of the outbreaks. And so you also don't want to, you got to be clear about somebody's been ill and you're not sure whether they had influenza, like they just had a cough for a couple of days, and maybe they're a case or maybe they're not a case. You don't want to be giving amantadine to them. And you have to keep a very careful watch for neurologic adverse events when you're using amantadine. You should stop amantadine in the occasional person who gets unexpected complications from it. Okay. What are you going to do about staff management? You need to classify your staff into vaccinated and unvaccinated. Staff who are vaccinated, you're going to allow free and complete access, remembering that vaccine is not 100% protective, so they do need to know that if they develop symptoms, even though they're going to be mild, they need to be off for the time that they have symptoms. But in general, once they're vaccinated, you can stop worrying about them. Unvaccinated staff, you have to classify into two groups. Now think about whether they've been exposed in the outbreak and might be incubating influenza or whether they've not been exposed. If they've been exposed, they're incubating influenza. If you want to stop them from getting sick and maintain them functional and able to work on the unit, you got to get prophylaxis to them as soon as possible. Okay? And that means setting up a system where you can call their pharmacy and they can get a supply filled at their pharmacy or some other mechanism of getting it out to them or of having them come down to the hospital to pick it up. Non-exposed staff, on the other hand, really are only going to start to get exposed when they come in to work on the unit, and it doesn't matter so much when they start prophylaxis. And yes, ideally, you'd like them to be on prophylaxis for a couple of hours before they come in, but the truth of the matter is, by the time they come into work and have contact with patients, if they take their first dose, you know, when they come through the door, it's probably going to be an hour before they've had a significant exposure, and they will have adequate protection, okay? And finally, you want to offer them vaccine again, particularly if it's early-ish in the season, for two reasons. The first is you might not succeed in controlling your outbreak. They may still be at risk even after the outbreak is over. And secondly, they may well have other exposures during the season, and you'd like them not to have to go through this process again. When you then deal with restricting staff, you need to restrict unvaccinated people who refuse prophylaxis. Now, if they're unexposed, then you can consider a policy that lets them work elsewhere, and that's a decision the facility has to make about how much time and trouble people are willing to go to accommodate unvaccinated staff who won't take prophylaxis. Remember, however, that they have to, if they've got a locker on that unit, do they otherwise go to that unit, do they want to go and hang out with their friends? The answer is no. They cannot be on that unit. If those unvaccinated staff who don't want prophylaxis have been exposed, then they can't work anywhere until their incubation period is complete. They've got to be a full 96 hours after their last exposure before you let them anywhere in the hospital. They are problematic for that period and can't work elsewhere. And finally, I think what we need to remember, there are a bunch of our administrative staff who are perhaps don't believe so much in influenza and don't want to punish people who do this, but we got to remember that hospital outbreaks occur in the setting of community activity, that in general institutional outbreaks are triggered by staff infection. And so when you move a bunch of unvaccinated people who refuse prophylaxis to other floors, you are clearly increasing the risk of outbreaks on those other floors. And that issue needs to be discussed when you and your institution write that policy. When you do that, you are taking a defined risk, and the whole institution needs to understand that you're taking that risk. Finally, with visitors, you need to think about whether you're going to, you're obviously not going to permit ill visitors because you don't want reintroductions. And the decision about overall restriction of visitors is fundamentally made based on the needs of nursing staff. If visitors are helpful in reducing workload when a lot of patients are ill, then they should be allowed. If the number of questions that visitors had are increased the workload on staff, that's in general the best reason for saying that visitors want to be restricted. And once again, in terms of stopping admission, a real emphasis on the more printed information you have for patients and visitors and the family about what's going on and why you're doing it, the easier it is for them to do the right thing and the less work it is for nursing staff dealing with them. Finally, when you're dealing with outbreaks, you need to think about what you're going to do with discharges, and a lot of that needs to be coordinated with public health and with your CCAC. People who are going home need to be aware that they might get, if they've been exposed on the unit and you're discharging them home now, they may get sick after they get home. And if you can organize it, it is probably best for them to continue to take oseltamivir until they've been at home for 3 or 4 days to protect them from developing illness. In general, when you have an influenza outbreak, you want to say that the floor is closed to discharges until the outbreak is completely over. But in fact, many of us are so dependent on transfers and discharges to keep beds open that there are circumstances where you can transfer people. And the last three bullets are the discussions we've had in Ontario about primarily long-term care institutions and when it's safe to transfer patients. So if transmission has stopped, you haven't had new cases for more than 2 days, if patients are more than 4 to 7 days after the onset of illness, or if they're taking oseltamivir, and that bottom line should say asymptomatic, not symptomatic, then the risk that they will transfer it is so small that it's probably quite safe to transfer them to other places if there are medical reasons why they need to go. And lastly, and I won't stop on these slides to give us a moment or two for questions, you need to then have a system in place so that you are evaluating whether the transmission stops. And in general, as you see on the next slide from Catherine Stainer's paper, once you start precautions, you will sometimes see cases over the next 48 hours, situations where people who've been incubating disease and your introduction of prophylaxis doesn't completely stop the development of illness. But then cases after that should be kind of expected rate of respiratory tract infection and should be negative for influenza. But because some influenza outbreaks fail to be controlled, even with amantadine prophylaxis and precautions, you really do need to be conscious of following people up and making sure that people who develop illness have nasopharyngeal swabs and you know what you're doing. And finally, in general, you need to make a decision that's discussed a little bit in the last slide about when you're going to call the outbreak over and when it's safe to say that things can go back to normal on the unit. And in acute care, truthfully, even more than long-term care, you need to be really conscious of the fact that you don't want to end up in the setting of restarting the outbreak. It's also invariably true that closures of units put enormous amounts of pressure on other areas of the hospital and sometimes other hospitals, and it really needs to be a balancing act of when the earliest possible time is that you can reopen and become functional. And I will stop there, and I hope, Paul, that we have a couple of minutes for questions.
We do. Thank you. Yes, I booked a little bit of extra time, so we have some time. I'll open the floor now for questions. If you have one, please take yourself off mute and please identify yourself by at least your first name and the facility or the city from which you're calling. The floor is now open for questions.
Allison, it's Ilana Warner from Seven Oaks Hospital in Winnipeg. And I just wondered what's happened with your mandatory flu vaccine for healthcare workers in Ontario.
Fundamentally, what happened in Ontario was that the government slotted vaccination into kind of existing programs. Okay, so there was a surveillance program for long-term care. There's things called OMA/OHA guidelines for acute care. But paramedics, for mysterious reasons, have their vaccine written into regulation. All vaccines, okay? Chickenpox, hepatitis B, the whole shoot and match. And so influenza just got added, and I think everybody was just in a hurry and nobody thought about the implications, okay? And then it got worse, okay? Because when paramedics started to twitch about it being mandatory, somebody at the ministry, not in the public health branch, decided that they were going to enforce the mandatory in the first year. That, I think, was a significant political error. The paramedics then took that to an arbitration process with the government, and the government would have won. Okay, there's absolutely no reason why the government couldn't do that. All of the other vaccines are on the list. They are mandatory for paramedics. I don't know that we enforce them, okay, but they are mandatory for paramedics. When you train as a paramedic in Ontario, it is made perfectly clear to you what the rules are, and in truth, the paramedics didn't have a leg to stand on. They started off with an argument that, you know, influenza vaccine is dangerous, yada, 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 and by the time we got through 8 months of that, they had stipulated that, you know, the vaccine was safe and it was good and all this stuff, and they were only basing their argument on it was unfair that it was mandatory for them and not for other people. But then the government decided that it would be a politically bad thing to do. We're facing an election, right, next year, and that they didn't want to do it, and so they walked away from it. Interestingly, I don't think it's had a big impact on our staff vaccination rates this year, but equally, our staff vaccination rates so far are not great in Ontario, and it's a really major challenge, you know, because from my perspective, when you look at the data, we're killing patients by not vaccinating staff,
mm-hmm.
and that, to me, is kind of unacceptable. On the other hand, we've done everything we can, I swear, what feels like everything we can at this hospital, and we're stuck at, you know, we might hit 50% of our staff this year, but we're not going to be higher. I really don't know. You know, and then you think about, you know, and everybody says, well, we can't make it mandatory.
Okay.
But, you know, seatbelts are mandatory.
Okay.
And when you ask people why it is they wear their seatbelt, a big reason they wear their seatbelt is because it's mandatory, even though they know it's good for them and they ought to do it. And so I think we're going to have to come back to re-asking the question, and I don't know where we're going to go with it because none of us want to do it, but I'm not sure that it's acceptable to live with the status quo, which says that we know we're putting our patients at risk when we shouldn't be.
Thanks.
Is there another question?
Chris Cameron, Cornwall, Ontario. Allison, do you have any secrets for getting physicians vaccinated?
Bribery data. There has been a shift in physicians. What works best for our physicians is patients and data. So we have a little package of articles that we send to doctors when we have a hard time with them, okay? And we don't give up, okay? And very slowly, it's taken a long time, but we are slowly beginning to get, this year for the first time in our hospital, every respirologist got his vaccine, okay? That's a first. Well, no, I think it's a second, okay, but still, it takes a long time to get physicians, but data tends to be what convinces them. So we've got a little package of adult side effects data and Potter's articles and stuff so that they can see that somebody's got academic credentials. You know, doctors don't want to believe you, okay, but they will believe articles in The Lancet on a good day.
That's a good point. They'll believe articles in The Lancet. Doctors.
Sometimes.
Okay.
Well, they'll believe them. They won't always do what they're told. Okay. You know, there remains a discrepancy there. But external data is good for doctors. The other thing, you know, anything that isn't coming from you, anything that comes from an external expert source, is more persuasive for doctors. But scientific articles work better than anything else I've found.
That was a very appropriate question for Christine to ask. She sent an email to me, oh gosh, back in September, perhaps August, asking if I can find out how to get staff vaccinated for influenza and how to deal with a influenza outbreak in acute care. And I thought it would be a small task, but it has become huge. And in fact, it's a worldwide issue, not just Canada and the U.S. We'll have lots of data on that to share with you very soon. Thank you for that, Christine. Is there another question? We have time for one, maybe two more.
This is Mary in Calgary. Can you hear me?
Yes, Mary. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Dr. McGeer to clarify or if she knows about when Tamiflu will be used for prophylaxis.
The answer is I don't know. The last I heard about it was about 4 months ago, and the HPB had sent a notice back to Roche saying that they were not going to license it for prophylaxis because there weren't appropriate indications for it. And I sent them a letter back saying, well, you know, my reading of the NACI recommendations was that there were, in fact, a very clear list of recommendations for antivirals. And the HPV response to that was that those were recommendations for amantadine, not for antivirals. So one of our problems with neuraminidase inhibitors now is that both Roche and Glaxo Welcome, the two in development, okay, the Ortho Janssen product and somebody else had a product, have both been dropped. And Roche is walking away from neuraminidase inhibitors, and I don't know what the right response is because they are unequivocally better drugs to use in some very high-risk patients. And I think it would be really terrible if we lost their benefit because of what I think is a reaction on the part of both public health people and Health Canada to marketing strategies that they didn't like. I'm sympathetic with them, okay? I don't like the way that Glaxo and Roche approach these either, but I do believe that we're stomping on drugs that are very effective and have a small but very clear indication, and I don't have a solution to that. It's of course, easy for acute care institutions, okay, because we can make any decision we like since it's on our global budget. And so at Sinai, we made a decision that we're going to use oseltamivir, and that's easy. And I know that there are some provinces who are looking at where the funding for outbreak management is centered in public health branch as opposed to other places that have made decisions under particular circumstances to use neuraminidase inhibitors. But for, you know, places like Ontario with long-term care where it has to be from the ODB and the ODB won't fund it unless it's approved by Health Canada, we still don't have access to it. And I have no solution to that beyond those of us who work in long-term care and who need the drugs continuing to make very loud noises about the inappropriateness of the situation. This is punishing people for living in nursing homes, and it doesn't seem to me like a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for one more question.
Could I, it's Mary again. Could I ask Dr. McGeer, would you suggest that if you have an identified amantadine outbreak that you treat the initial or index case with Tamiflu or something like that rather than put them on amantadine?
The first thing to remember about treatment is if people have been sick for more than 48 hours, it doesn't matter what you do. Okay, they shouldn't get anything because nothing will be of benefit to them. The second thing is that in treating people who've been sick for less than 48 hours, there is no doubt that you're then mixing a high concentration of virus with the amantadine, and those are the circumstances in which you select for amantadine resistance. So people get into this trap because treating with amantadine probably reduces the severity and duration of symptoms, but the data that it does that is not actually very good, okay? And we don't have any data on whether it reduces the rate of complications. But you hate not to treat somebody who's sick, okay? And all of us physicians faced with sick people would like to do something for them, okay? And so it's hard to say don't treat with amantadine in that circumstance. But clearly treating with amantadine puts you at risk of getting a resistant infection. Now, the reason that I would treat with oseltamivir is that we do have data with oseltamivir that treatment reduces the duration and severity of illness if you start early. And in fact, if there's a paper that the first author on is Susan Bowles, B-O-W-L-E-S, that looked at the year of our compassionate use program for oseltamivir for hospitals that had amantadine-resistant outbreaks, primarily in Ontario in 99-2000. And when we sent nursing homes oseltamivir in that program, we gave them recommendations about whether they could treat, but we didn't give them any firm rules, okay, about what they were to treat with. And a long time afterwards, somebody finally said to me, well, you know, what happens with the treatment? And I thought, wasn't why we did the analysis. But when you look at the treatment in that trial, residents who got oseltamivir did much better and were significantly less likely to need antibiotics or to be hospitalized or to die. And I think the answer might be that it's those circumstances where you treat really early, right? You notice that patients are symptomatic, and whereas outpatients, it's really hard to get them on any therapy for influenza within the first 24 hours of illness. In the long-term care setting, you can, okay? You do know pretty much when they start getting ill with influenza, and you can get them on treatment really early. And so even though that paper's not randomized, it was very convincing to me that oseltamivir reduces the severity of illness, and although it costs more money, the trade-off in reduction in antibiotic use and needing to transfer out to the hospital does get you back at least a substantial portion of that money. So I think even if you're using amantadine for prophylaxis, I think that if you have that for that small group of people who've been ill for less than 48 hours, that using oseltamivir allows you to feel better about treating them, optimizes their care, and doesn't cost a whole lot of money.
I'm going to have to bring the questioning to a close. We're a little bit beyond our time, but as I said, we did have extra time, so we're okay. On behalf of everyone who is listening, Dr. McGeer, I want to thank you very much for your participation and the incredible information that you've shared with us. You've surprised me on a great deal of things, and I'm sure that there's new information for many of us. And from me, I would like to thank all of you who are joining. I am very grateful that you've taken this time to spend with us, and I hope that you will be able to download all of the stuff that I'm going to send you very, very soon on how to get staff immunized and dealing with influenza and all that sort of thing. It comes from all over the world. Thank you again for your participation. The next official teleclass, the next big one, is on reprocessing medical devices in September the 5th with Dr. Michelle Alpha. Hope that you'll join us for that. And either way, I thank you once again and have a fantastic day. Dr. McGeer, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.